Europe surprises investors with a bank bailout deal.
And from restaurants to insurers to entrepreneurs to the Tea Party, we're tracking the implications of the health reform ruling from the Supreme Court. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Friday, June 29th. Coming up, we are going to hear all about the Supreme Court ruling and the wildfires in Colorado, which are really not getting under control yet.
And we'll talk about that agreement in Europe that seems to have investors in a good mood today. That's coming up after this.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
First to the day's big global economic story, a summit of European leaders has yielded agreement on two key points. First, the EU as a whole will lend directly to banks wherever they get into trouble. Second, there's going to be a new agency to supervise banks across the continent. Our London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is here. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So the status quo right now when banks get underwater in, say, Spain, is for the EU to give bailout money to Spain, which then bails out its banks. How is this going to change, and why is that such a big deal?
Right. Well, the bailout fund is going to be allowed to pump money directly into the banks, not, as you say, give to the governments. Because when they lent to the governments, those loans increased the government's debt, which hit the value of its existing bonds, mm-hmm. which are largely held by the banks, making the bank situation more difficult. And then the governments have to borrow more money to help the banks. So the idea is break the vicious circle. You lend the money directly to the banks. And that should help Spain.
The other big part of this deal is a new supervisor of sorts for banks across Europe. And what's the hope there?
Right. Well, this is Germany's quid pro quo. It wants a Europe-wide bank supervisor, so there is some central control over what these banks are up to, essentially so the Germans can watch what the banks are doing with their money and make sure it isn't being frittered away.
So this deal fixes everything then, does it?
No. Nobody believes this is the end of the crisis, not by a long chalk. Some analysts, however, believe that it is another small step down the road to an ultimate solution of the crisis that's engulfed the southern peripheral countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy. Here's Holger Schmieding of the German bank Berenbergs.
The countries on the Eurozone periphery have been set on a diet to get slim and fit. And you don't achieve the result of a diet in a day. The countries need to be kept on their best behavior for quite a while.
Diets can be painful, he says, but they don't go on forever.
Stephen Beard in London, thank you.
Okay, Jeff.
And of course, we've been digging much further today into the Supreme Court's decision on health care and its implications for the American economy.
That's right. A real mix of opinions about that decision. It's being hailed as good news for people without health insurance. But more than 80% of Americans do have health insurance, and more than 55% of us get it through our employer. Marketplace's Eve Troh reports now on what the ruling means for the insured.
If you work for a company with more than 50 employees, and that's most of us, your health care will likely be the same in 2014 as it is today.
The great majority of employers are going to continue to offer coverage commensurate to what they've had before or better.
Michael Thompson advises companies on healthcare at PricewaterhouseCoopers. I asked him how the court ruling would impact the cost to employees.
It will continue to evolve like it has been evolving.
Meaning you will keep paying more year after year for your company health plan, but no more than you would have paid without the Affordable Care Act. Now, if your company health plan costs more than 9.5% of your income, you have a choice, says Karen Politz at the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can buy one of the new, cheaper insurance plans created by the Affordable Care Act.
If you do that, then your employer can be subject to penalties.
Penalties for not providing employees with affordable health care. I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
And now for some reaction to the Supreme Court's historic ruling. Senator Rand Paul is a Republican from Kentucky who opposed the law and opposes the Supreme Court's decision on the law. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for being here. I want to start by asking you about some comments that you made yesterday that have gotten a lot of attention. You said, quote, "Just because a couple people on the Supreme Court declare something to be constitutional does not make it so. The whole thing remains unconstitutional." Do you stand by that statement?
You know, I still agree with Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and Alito that the Constitution doesn't justify the law.
You think you're agreeing with the dissenters, but that was not the ruling that the Supreme Court came down with.
Right, but that's all I'm saying is if you ask Justice Scalia, does he think the law is constitutional, he'll still tell you no. So I'm entitled to have my opinion as to what is constitutional and what is not. No one's talking about whether or not the ruling has validity or not. I'm just saying that I agree with the dissenters that I don't believe the law is constitutional, and I think Madison would also agree. Madison said that the laws, you know, when we talk about the tax and spending power, that it's regulated by the enumerated powers of, that are given to Congress. If the powers aren't enumerated, doesn't mean that you can have any sort of tax that you want to do any sort of policy you'd like.
But you respect the ruling now as the law of the land.
Yeah, nobody's questioning the law or nobody's questioning the Supreme Court. So all the ridiculous left-wing bloggers need to get a clue. All I'm saying is that I agree with Scalia that I don't believe the law was constitutional.
Well, what is the next step for you, Senator, in terms of getting this law repealed, which I assume you want to do now?
Well, and that we do through the ballot box, and I think this is going to energize the conservative base, the Tea Party wing of our party. I predict that you're going to see increasingly larger and larger crowds as we talk about trying to have an election where we overturn this. And by saying I overturn this, still doesn't mean we actually overturn the ruling. There are probably a lot of things that could be deemed constitutional that we don't have, but we can repeal this through an election.
Senator Rand Paul is a Republican of Kentucky. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Now the view from the U.S. health insurance industry, which has already put in tremendous work on a law that could have been vaporized, but it wasn't. And to see how the road looks from here, I've got Matt Manders. He runs the U.S. division of Cigna, one of the country's biggest insurers. Good morning.
Appreciate it, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So is this decision by the Supreme Court just a total relief to you, or was there any part of you hoping this thing would go down?
No, you know, actually, Cigna's approach about this has been really from the context of our customers, and we try to separate the political issues with essentially what the real problem is that we're trying to solve, which is around giving every American the opportunity and what they want and what they deserve around better and more affordable health care.
Insurance companies like yours have been operating under a tremendous amount of uncertainty here. Had you been holding back at all in implementing this giant law, and do you need to play any catch-up now that you have some clarity?
No, Jeff. Actually, the provisions of the law actually first started kicking in on September 23rd of 2010. From our position, there have been numerous compliance elements that we've needed to do the appropriate work. So, no, we recognize that the only way that we could be compliant on time with the regulations was to work down the path, assuming that the law would be upheld as it was.
Do you really have clarity now? Republicans would still like to repeal this thing, presumably, and they might get a shot at it.
Well, I think what we have is clarity for a piece of it, which is from the Supreme Court's perspective. But as you've stated, and I couldn't agree with you more, Jeff, this isn't the final chapter of this novel. And the upcoming elections will continue to add elements of potential change or potential volatility. So from our perspective, we see it very much the way that you're looking at it and the way you're thinking about it.
So for Cigna customers, they're waking up today and this law is going forward. Is there anything different that they can expect from Cigna?
No, actually, with the decision around the law taking place, you know, on Thursday, the reality is we're sending messages to our customers specifically so that they understand there will be no changes to their plans or their policies at all at this time, and that, you know, we will continue in the future to move forward, and they should expect the provisions as the way that they're laid out in the law.
Matt Manders, he heads the U.S. division of the health insurer Cigna. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Well, one industry that is generally worried about the law is the restaurant industry. Karen Bremer is the executive director of the Georgia Restaurant Association, and she's with us now from Atlanta. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about your concerns right now about what the health care law is going to do to the restaurant industry.
The effect is going to be staggering. The estimates that restaurateurs were sharing with me yesterday, they're looking at added costs to their insurance of almost $1 million in 2014. So the result of that is going to be that the market will be looking forward to reduced staffing sizes, which is going to impact your service when you dine in restaurants. Wages are either going to have to be frozen or lowered.
Was the restaurant industry basically then sitting back and hoping that the Supreme Court would say that this law was unconstitutional? I mean, were they not preparing for this as if it were going to go into effect ever since it was passed?
Yes. As many restaurateurs this past year have said to me, you know, I've said, how are you dealing with it? What are you planning on? And it's, well, these are the kind of estimates that we're getting. We don't know how to act because we do not know where this money is going to come from. It's been the white elephant in many an office and in many a restaurant company.
Now, the law only requires that places that have 50 or more full-time or full-time equivalent employees have health insurance provided by their employer, or they have to pay penalties. So, I mean, this is not going to affect mom-and-pop places, I assume.
Well, it'll affect a mom-and-pop place if they have more than one location, if they have 50 employees collectively. And the restaurants that have been operating on the edge and just starting to come out of this recession, those will be the restaurants that will be closing.
Karen Bremmer is the executive director of the Georgia Restaurant Association. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And finally, the view for entrepreneurs. Like restaurants, many small business groups have mostly panned the Affordable Care Act. They dislike the paperwork and the fines for not offering employees health coverage. But for some entrepreneurs, it might clear a big obstacle to starting a company. From our entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, here's Mitchell Hartman.
Entrepreneurs will be able to shop for group health plans on new insurance exchanges. Today, they're stuck with individual plans, skimpy and expensive. Sarah Horowitz of the Freelancers Union says that'll give every American
the same kind of health care, whether they work for themselves, for a small company, a big company. The idea that good benefits only come with jobs is over.
Anyone whose job doesn't come with insurance will have to buy it or pay a penalty. The National Association for the Self-Employed complains that's a financial burden. But entrepreneurship scholar Vivek Wadhwa says the benefits outweigh the costs.
The average age of a technology entrepreneur is 39. What happens if I have a heart attack? What happens if I get ill? So this is going to make a big difference in the ability of people to start companies so that all they have to worry about then is a business plan, not health insurance.
Wadhwa launched a startup and 5 years later had that heart attack. By then, he could afford insurance. Otherwise, he'd be bankrupt and the startup could have failed. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So we've been talking about healthcare all morning and a little different topic now. But is foie gras, Jeremy, is that a healthy food?
I'm doubting it. That's pretty fatty stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. People do love it, we have to say. But here in California, it is the last week. People have, I think, 2 days left to buy foie gras. Hmm. And it's made, for folks who don't know, it's made from the fattened liver of force-fed geese. And the state has decided that it is cruel. Of course, I've never seen it done. It doesn't sound nice. We'll say that. And so folks are going foie gras nuts out here. You can get foie gras waffles, foie gras toffee, foie gras ice cream sandwiches,
Apparently.
And with the deadline looming, fans are stuffing themselves.
Oh, well, you know, Jeff, actually, I've seen a restaurant in Chicago where they have foie gras popsicles and foie gras cotton candy.
Huh.
So the people like to do all kinds of things with that foie gras. But now to New Zealand, where you have to really be careful what you wear to work. A reporter there went to cover a trial in the Wellington High Court and was kicked out because she was wearing gold sequined disco pants.
Oh.
Now, we don't have tape of that incident, but I'm guessing, just guessing, that it went something like this from the movie My Cousin Vinny.
Are you mocking me with that outfit?
Mocking you? No, I'm not mocking you, Judge.
Then explain that outfit.
I bought a suit. You've seen it. Now it's covered in mud. This town doesn't have a one-hour cleaner, so I had to buy a new suit. Except that the only store you could buy a new suit in has got the flu. You get that? The whole store got the flu. So I wore this ridiculous thing for you.
I don't know. Maybe it didn't go like that, but let's leave it to our imaginations.
Municipal pools opened in New York City this week. Beaches and pools in other parts of the country have been open for a while, or maybe never closed like they do here in L.A. And yet, many of them are facing a critical problem, lifeguard shortages.
That's right. From Tulsa to Minneapolis, cities are having a hard time finding enough people to work summer lifeguard jobs. To see where this shortage is coming from, we turn to Connie Harvey. She works in the aquatics program for the American Red Cross, and she's with us from Brevard County, Florida. Hi, Connie.
Good morning.
Well, what's going on here? Why a shortage of lifeguards?
The Red Cross is actually a training agency. We are not an employment agency. Interestingly, our training numbers are still remaining very high with lifeguarding. In fact, over the last 5 years, we've been increasing steadily, and this year we're at about those same numbers as well. So from the training side, the Red Cross is not seeing that there is indeed a shortage of lifeguards. There could be several factors at play here where those facilities are experiencing a shortage, and it could be as simple as many facilities have added features and attractions to their facilities, such as slides or inflatables that kids can play on. When you have those kind of items in a pool, it increases the need for lifeguards. Also, we have more water parks that are bringing on many more lifeguards. So it could be that the demand for lifeguards is higher, and so some of the more traditional places are having a bit of a struggle.
We hear a lot about how many young people are unemployed. Is it a complicated, difficult thing for them to get certified and take some of these jobs if there are shortages in places?
Well, of course, there has to be a basic level of skill to become a lifeguard. And it is not the same as going to work at a retailer. They have to have a pretty solid swimming ability. And having that basic level of knowing how to swim is sometimes a stopping point for folks.
So these people have to be pretty physically talented. And so I'm wondering, how much can they make in this profession?
You know, the amount of money that they make is very geographical in nature. You know, where you are is going to dictate the income that they can get. And the type of facility where you work will also be impacted by that. So the ones who are working in a traditional swimming pool may make less, you know, $8 to $10 an hour. And then as it goes into more complicated facilities, such as water parks, or if you go to a surf environment where it is a year-round and additional certification is required, then that pay can be higher.
I think where we're hearing about shortages is in sort of the municipal pool context. So I suppose that makes sense, right, that in maybe smaller towns or in pools, you need those lifeguards, but those jobs, you're saying maybe they don't pay enough to attract even the teenagers that would usually train for them.
Well, and another issue with the lifeguarding profession is that it is seasonal in nature, and many kids nowadays are looking for year-round employment. And so that also adds to the complexity of it. But the thing is, lifeguarding is such a positive experience for folks. It gives youth such a different perspective and a different level of experience that you would get in other places. For example, number one, you have a skill to save a life. You know, this is something that can translate into many things, from the ability to help somebody who's in trouble in the water. It's also leadership that they learn. You know, they're going to be sitting up there and having an expectation of keeping a facility in check, having to sometimes correct people who are older than them. So they learn customer service skills. They learn communication skills. You know, just lifeguarding is a very professional job these days, and they get that in their training, and then they get that once they're on the job as well. So it's a great resume builder.
Maybe some different aspects to it than your typical summer job at McDonald's.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, Connie, thank you very much. That's Connie Harvey with the Aquatics Program for the American Red Cross. Thanks.
Thank you, Connie.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Now on to some other items we're watching this morning. On Sunday, voters in Mexico go to the polls to elect the new president. And a lot of U.S. companies that do business south of the border will also be watching very closely. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
At this plant near Mexico City, workers assemble cars for Ford. Next month, the company will crank out almost 10% more Ford Fiestas to meet rising demand, mostly from the U.S. Juan Santillan oversees production. He says changes on the domestic landscape could also benefit the company.
There's a lot of things that the government can still do in order to promote more investment.
Presidential candidate Enrique Peña Nieto, who is expected to win the election on Sunday, already has a relationship with the company. As state governor, he was here for the plant's inauguration. If elected, he's promised to cut the cost of electricity and invest in infrastructure. Santillan says those moves would help all foreign manufacturers in the area, not just Ford.
So the ideal is that this central part of Mexico gets developed so big that at the end all can benefit from it.
Candidate Peña Nieto has also promised reforms that would benefit American oil companies. Manuel Molano is with the Mexican Institute for Competitiveness, a think tank in Mexico City. He says the proposed changes would erode the monopoly now held by Mexico's national oil company called Pemex.
This would mean that more foreign companies could come and compete against Pemex in several aspects of the business.
Milano expects some business reforms no matter who wins the election.
Whatever the outcome is, there are good news for American businesses.
All the major candidates have promised to tackle corruption, and two have spoken of the need to reform outdated labor laws. Joy Langston is a political science professor at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics. She says the government needs to make it easier for companies to fire people.
If somebody works at your office for a week and then leaves, you are legally obligated to pay them 3 months of salary. And so that leads to all sorts of fraud and all sorts of abuse.
As those workplace abuses decrease, Mexico becomes more attractive for American businesses. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Destructive wildfires continue to burn across Colorado, but officials are being careful in how they describe the blaze. They don't want to scare away tourists, as Megan Verlee from Colorado Public Radio reports.
In 2002, the last time wildfire season was this bad, Colorado's then governor infamously told the press, "All of Colorado is burning today." B&B owner Sally Clark says those words had an immediate impact.
It was devastating to us, and people were canceling reservations right and left.
Many tourism companies blame that remark for killing the entire summer season, which may explain why current Governor John Hickenlooper had such a precise answer when asked about how much of the state has burned so far this summer.
Less than 1%, so it's a very small percentage.
But with all the headlines, would-be visitors could be forgiven for thinking the entire state is under a pall of smoke. Colorado Tourism Director Al White says his office is trying to counter that by providing up-to-date information to people who ask. But it's a tricky business promoting the state right now.
If we get out there nationally and say, hey, pay no attention to the fires, there's no big deal, come on out and play, they're going to say, what?
White says the real effort will begin once the fires are out, to make sure Colorado's increasingly smoky reputation doesn't linger in people's minds. In Denver, I'm Megan Verlee for Marketplace.
The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC, is flexing its regulatory muscle. Like a lot of folks in Washington, the OCC is not amused that investment bank J.P. Morgan now looks to lose $5 billion from derivatives bets gone bad.
So the OCC is telling J.P. Morgan to show the agency the trading models that caused the problem. That's undoubtedly kind of a humbling thing for the bank and not something J.P. Morgan's competitors would be anxious to endure either. Here to talk about it is Cliff Rossi. He's executive in residence and he teaches at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Welcome.
Very good.
One reason this is big news today is that regulators are apparently done taking J.P. Morgan's word for it. They want to see the actual model, these proprietary models. Is this kind of hands-on approach, I guess, going to become more common, do you think?
It will become more common as these kinds of events occur, let's say. But just to be clear, the OCC and other bank regulators, as a matter of course, actually already require, as a part of their ongoing supervision and examination of these firms, review of the various models that are used for assessing risk at these institutions.
Well, they must use that power somewhat gently. You would think J.P. Morgan might worry, for example, whether the comptroller of the currency is really competent to understand and decide what's best for J.P. Morgan and which models work and which ones don't.
That's one way to interpret it, but you have to remember at these very largest institutions, it would be a very difficult task to expect any federal regulator to be able to get under the covers of specific models. Now, having said that, the model here in question was of such significance that it should have surfaced to the top, both for J.P. Morgan's risk governance processes, but also by the OCC in their examination processes too.
JP Morgan presumably doesn't like losing $5 billion from models that go wrong, and I'm sure they wouldn't want to do it again. Why do we need the government to come in and attempt to help here?
Well, first of all, because these are systemically important, very large entities for which the taxpayers are on the hook if they are to go down. There has to be very close supervision of the activities, particularly the very riskiest activities that these institutions engage in.
Cliff Rossi at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeff, there's a subway station in Brooklyn where one of the exits, one of the stairway exits, has a little bit of a problem.
Okay.
The sixth step from the top of the stairway is about a half an inch taller than the rest, which doesn't seem like a very big deal, but it's just enough to make just about everybody who walks up those stairs trip when they go over that step. And a guy named Dean Peterson, who I guess lives nearby, put together a video of the tripping, of all these people tripping over and over again on the step, and it went viral online.
Brilliant.
That was a couple of days ago. Well, the transit agency responded, and according to the New York Times, the stairway should be fixed by tomorrow. So pretty amazing.
Bully
you just make a viral video and
yeah,
there you go.
Bully for everybody involved, I guess, and bully for the Transit Authority for eventually stepping up. So to speak.
That's right. Stepping up. Zing. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. It's the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.